Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast-to-coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania on Sirius Satellite Radio, on XM Radio on Sunday, this program rebroadcast. Also on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, and CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's the our 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. We do this program the first hour of Friday, the first hour of the last day of the week. We always dedicate to Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I consider him, frankly, America's congressman. He's such a great guy. His website, Bernie.org. And Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. And by the way, I want to let folks know if they want to call in, if they have a question, comment, whatever. I know you love to take calls. The telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. That's 1-866-440-THOM. Is our new toll-free number. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. Bernie, apropos of, I'm sure you have a list of political things
yep.
you'd like to talk about.
Sure.
Do you mind if I talk to you about your personal electoral politics for just a moment?
Sure.
I just read an article in the paper that the guy who has declared that he's going to run against you for the United States Senate from Vermont is putting $5 million of his own money into a campaign. And I suspect that dwarfs whatever you have. How is it that we've come? Let me take this to the larger picture rather than, you can comment on that to whatever extent you want. But the larger picture is, how is it that we've come to the point where people like that guy, people like Bloomberg, who I think spent about $75 per vote in the last election versus his opponent, who spent about $17 per vote, the Democrat. How is it that we've come to this in America where wealthy people can simply buy their way into an election?
If we talk about the corruption in the deepest sense of the word of American politics, that's what we're talking about. What I can tell you, Tom, is that virtually every piece of legislation that gets to the floor of the House is bought and paid for by some powerful special interest corporate organization. And the way that works, the way these guys do it, is by contributing huge sums of money to both parties, but mostly, I must say, to the Republican Party, and also we have created a mechanism by which huge amounts of money go to individual candidates. And what has happened is with both political parties, again, the Republicans more than the Democrats, but both parties have said, look, we want people who are what they call self-funders. Why do we want to raise money for you who don't have a lot of money? If it's going to cost millions of dollars, we want you to raise it for yourself. And ideally, if you have the money, that's what we want. A very good friend of mine in Congress was giving thought to running for the Senate. And people said to him, no, we don't want you. There's another guy who's thinking of running who's a multimillionaire. We'd rather have him than you. The end result of it is that in the Senate now, it's hard to say exactly because we just don't know. The forms that we have to fill out are not that clear. But about 60% of the members of the United States Senate themselves are millionaires. But that only tells half the story because many other people who are not themselves millionaires are dependent upon big money to get elected. People are going out to all kinds of special interest organizations to raise huge sums of money. And then, of course, they are indebted to those people when they get elected. And it's a very sad state of affairs. And if we are serious about making the government of the United States work for ordinary people, if we are serious about seeing the middle class expand rather than collapse, if we're serious about seeing poverty eliminated rather than grow, health care for all people, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, a trade policy that works for American workers and poor people around the world rather than just large corporations, the environment so that our kids can breathe clean air rather than see pollution coming from the Midwest to the Northeast, et cetera, et cetera. All of those issues are directly tied to how we fund campaigns and who puts money into elections. Now, what's the answer to that? In my view, the answer is a very simple one. It's controversial, but it's simple. And that is we need public funding of elections, and limits on the amount of money that can be spent. Because if we use elections just as a commodity, you can spend as much money as you want. You can run as many negative 30-second ads as you want. What we're going to end up with is what we have now, even worse, and that is big money controlling almost every aspect of the political process.
Yeah, there's a dynamic tension here between the concept of one man, one vote, or one person,
right,
one vote, that is, each one of us should be able to speak out and have our vote counted, versus if money equals speech, then more speech.
Right. One person, one vote, you and I are equal. But if you have 100 times more money than I do, and you contribute that money to the national political party, you contribute that money to candidates who raise your interest, in reality, you are far, far, far more powerful than I am, who just has one vote.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what is going on right now. And again, you know, Tom DeLay is being indicted and so forth and so on, but the real issue of Tom DeLay, and he admitted this to Newsweek, you know, he had boasted about it, and then he pretty much admitted it, is that when people come into his office, he doesn't talk to people who are not prepared to contribute to the Republican Party. He's not interested in them. If you have money to contribute, they will take your needs seriously, and you can bet that it gets to the floor thus. And just look at the examples. Tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires, a disastrous trade policy that benefits large corporations, an energy policy that gives billions in corporate welfare to the oil companies, a bankruptcy bill which was written by the credit card companies, a prescription drug Medicare bill that was written by the pharmaceutical industries, et cetera, et cetera. And then you check it out and find out where these guys, Republican Party, gets their money from, straight from these guys.
Yeah,
not complicated.
Right, and in the last election cycle, the 2004 election cycle, $1 billion was spent in media advertising, $1 billion. I believe in the 2000 cycle, it was about a half $1 billion. But let's work with $1 billion. To generate $1 billion, if 125 million taxpayers, which is about how many taxpayers we have, checked off a box on their form and gave $5 each year for each of the 4 years time between two presidential elections, that would generate $1 billion.
That's right
there. And so if everybody just gave $5 a year, you'd have the exact same amount of money as was in the entire last campaign, and it would come from public sources, and so there wouldn't be that advantage. Is that the kind of thing you have
exactly
in mind?
Right. That's exactly right. And if we made radio and television open up to candidates so that they can express their point of view rather than having to spend a fortune on ads. You know, in Vermont, frankly, it's different. You know, I have the opportunity to talk to real people at real meetings. But if you go out to California, you're running for governor or senator, you know, talking to people is a waste of time. What these guys do, they don't have the time to do that or the inclination. What they do is raise money by the gazillions, and they put TV ads on.
Right.
And there are almost no debates. And that's the future of American politics. Raise huge sums of money, put TV ads on, obfuscate the real issues. And that is really pathetic if we're concerned about a real and vibrant democracy.
But it used to be that media had an obligation. In order to maintain their licenses to use the public airwaves, they had to say, we will sponsor debates, we will allow the candidates to speak, we'll have, you know, balanced discussions of the issues. That all
in other
went
words,
away.
To get the airwaves, we're going to use them for the public good.
Right. That all went away with Ronald Reagan.
You're absolutely right, and that is, of course, ancient history. Now, give us the airwaves so we can make huge sums of money, and that's about it. Yeah. But one of the issues I wanted to segue into, if I
could, sure.
There was an interesting quote that I think listeners should hear. This is a quote that comes within the context of workers all over America, whether it's the Delphi Corporation or other companies, seeing substantial cutbacks in their wages, in their health care benefits, and in their pensions. One of the reasons for this, in my view, is our disastrous trade policies, especially with countries like China, where American workers are being forced to compete with people who make 30, 50 cents an hour. Those trade policies were pushed on the Congress, paid for, in terms of lobbying, as we just talked about, by groups like the National Association of Manufacturers. In the midst of all of these cuts, here's what a guy named Jerry Jasinowski, who's president of the Manufacturing Institute at the National Association of Manufacturers, said. This is what he said recently, quote, from airline pilots to auto assembly workers, employees need to help reduce their costs. He said, we can't afford to live with the very generous benefits we provided 10 to 15 years ago, end of quote. In other words, the National Association of Manufacturers and the other big corporate interests push a policy on us. And then they say, oh, guess what? As a result of that policy, your wages have to go down, your health care benefits have to go down, your pensions have to go down. Guess what? And what these guys are essentially saying is there is a war now taking place against the middle class. And we're not just talking about a 2% decline in health care. We're talking about savage cuts in wages and other benefits.
It's the race to the bottom.
It is the race to the bottom, accelerated.
Amazing. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls and Bernie Sanders right after this, 8:16. We're 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, just give us the truth. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org or house.bernie.gov. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. That's 440-THOM. And Steve in Savannah, Georgia, you are live and on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Congressman Sanders. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good.
As you know, I'm a Republican. Now, the campaign financing, I got 2 points. Campaign financing, I've always felt there's equal money on both sides of just about every issue. I know you can find exceptions, but there's equal money on both sides of just about every issue.
Okay, can I jump in and just say that that's really not really true. I think you will find no question that Democrats raise a heck of a lot of money. Don't want to deny that for one moment. But I think you will find that the Republicans, time after time, raise substantially more money and often.
And individual donations, I mean, in the 2000, but the soft one is about the same. But
But Steve, you're saying equal money on an issue. I mean, how do you take like an issue like the drug bill in Medicaid or Medicare rather, where the pharmaceutical companies are pumping millions into this thing, and you and I are on the other side? We've got no money at all to give to them. There's not even a mechanism to do it.
AARP and unions, the Association for Retired People and Unions. That's the offset on the money for donations.
Right, but here's two points. Let me respond. 2 points. Number one. I think if you check it out, say in terms of the pharmaceutical issue, drug companies pour in zillions more than anybody else. But here's the point. You're right. The other side also pours the money. I think what we want to do is lessen the kinds of money that comes in from all over the place so we can have serious debates on the issue. But to answer you, I think if you look at issues like the trade policy, if you look at issues like prescription drugs, if you look at issues like energy, you will find that corporate America and their friends pour in a lot more money than the other side. Okay, I think that's...
Okay, I might give you that, but on the wage, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm a truck driver. My wages have gone up 20% in the last 3 years because there's a shortage of truck drivers right now.
Okay.
And in the labor market, truck drivers, I think it starts in the beginning. If there's a shortage of truck drivers, and we're at 5.1% unemployment, when the baby boomers start retiring, we're going to have it's going to be a laborer's market in the next 10 years.
Okay, let me answer that. Obviously, there are parts of the country, and you're probably in one of them, where workers or truck drivers, in this case, may be doing pretty well. But what I have to tell you is that nationally, the facts are very, very clear that for the vast majority of working people, their wages are not keeping up with inflation. If you are doing better than inflation, you're doing good. But you are in a real minority. Go out and talk to some of your friends. And in many instances, their wages have not kept up with inflation. They're losing their pensions. They're asked to pay for more health care. And that is really not a debatable statistic. That's really true. So you're a lucky guy. Congratulations.
There you go. Steve, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Steve.
Brian in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Brian, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good.
just wanted to make mention, I received something. I'm a nurse case manager with Department of Health Services for the state of California, and case managed the top 3-4% most critically ill and injured Medi-Cal patients. And the proposal now going through Congress, I believe, is to cut over $10 billion from the Medicaid program.
Well, the president originally, as I recall, wanted to cut $50 billion, and Congress has not allowed him to do that. They're still being debated, but there will be cuts which will be absolutely devastating.
Well, I think this is a pretty wrong-headed move considering Hurricane Katrina,
right.
Wilma, Rita, all this stuff that's coming on, people losing their jobs and things
that's
like
exactly.
that.
That's exactly. Brian, what's happening is small businesses are unable to provide health insurance to their workers. More and more people are going on to the government health care programs, including Medicaid.
Right.
So if you cut back on those programs, one of two things are going to happen. People are going to lose benefits, go off the system, or else the states and local municipalities are going to have to pick up the differences. But at a time of a health care crisis, you certainly don't cut back on Medicaid. And I have to tell you, while the president wants to cut back on Medicaid, he is proposing more tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, which does not make a lot of sense to me.
Could I make a suggestion of
sure.
where to perhaps find that $10 billion? I was listening to a progressive radio here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the commentator was mentioning that for the past year, there has been no Department of Defense oversight for $140 billion that has been plopped into Iraq. And I think if you just cut $10 billion off of that, stick it back into Medicaid, I'm sure they'll still have more than enough money to play with over there irresponsibly.
Well, I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think that is one area that we can look. In fact, there are many areas.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Good to hear from you. Bernie, we have about 30 seconds here before we have to take a break. What do you see as the biggest issue that's going through Congress right now?
Well, the biggest issue, I mean, Brian touched on it. The Republican leadership are proposing devastating cuts in health care and education, while at the same time, I have to say, they're looking at more tax breaks for their wealthy campaign contributors.
Yeah, and you know, whack it to the middle class one more time.
That's right.
It's tragic. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs.
And welcome
Every
back.
Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, because I always wanted me one that was long and black.
Johnny Cash.
One day
I was singing about a working man. Great music. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by EcoWine, 1-888-ECOWINE, 1-888-ECOWINE for imported French organic wines. Welcome back to our program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the independent congressman from Vermont, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Rick, listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes, good day, Tom and Bernie. Bernie, I heard you and Tom discussing the disastrous trade policies, including with China, and how the National Association of Manufacturers promote that sort of thing, and I think it's fair to say they're on the right side of the right-wing side of the political spectrum. But
yes.
What's interesting to me about this, though, and this cognitive dissonance that Republicans and Republican voters have. Now, you remember how they were trying to smear Bill Clinton with this idea that he was being a traitor for selling military secrets to China. So China
yep.
is this big boogeyman. So, in other words, they're a military threat, but when it comes time to do business with them, then it's okay. How do you explain that?
Well, you're right. There's a real dissonance there. And you could take it even a step further. It wasn't so many years ago when you had many of these right-wing guys who were saying, look, China is a terrible, authoritarian, communist country. They're a real threat to us, a threat to freedom around the world, et cetera, et cetera. And now, for many of these corporate leaders, they are our best friends. They are a great place to do business, and that's really what's going on. If you can pay workers 30 cents an hour, 50 cents an hour, if they go to jail, if they try to form an independent union, what better place can you find to do business? And what's happened, of course, is not only have we lost millions of decent-paying jobs in this country going to China, but what we're seeing now in terms of the race to the bottom is many of these companies who supported the trade agreement with China are now saying, if you don't take a 10% cut in your wages, major cuts in your health care, we're going to China. We don't need you anymore. So this is a huge issue. We have a gargantuan trade deficit with China. It's growing every single year. If we don't get a handle on that, there's going to be very little left to our manufacturing base in America and to the middle class, in fact.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Our telephone number, 1-866, toll-free, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And Tim in Port Orchard, Washington, listening on KPTK, about to celebrate a year of Progressive Talk Radio in Seattle. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, regarding Harriet Myers, if with all the indictments that's coming down on the Bush administration, this seems pretty unprecedented. You know, his credibility is absolutely gone through the floor. His moral capital was nothing but a bubble that was burst. What's the possibility of the Democrats just filibustering any future nomination? Just, you know, on the grounds that you've got a corrupt president and really doesn't have, you know, he wasn't elected. And
Well, the issue here is this nominee worthy of being on the Supreme Court? And that's the issue that the Senate has to deal with and the Judiciary Committee there has to deal with. I think the initial concern that a lot of people have, including some very conservative people, is, okay, tell us about her judicial and legal experience. Well, you know what? There's not a whole lot to suggest that, in fact, she is qualified, that she has the background and experience to be on the Supreme Court. It seems that from the president's perspective, her strongest qualification, A, is she's a religious person, and B, he has known her and she is loyal to him. Are those the criteria that really we should have, the only criteria, to hold the one of the most important positions in U.S. government? And I think a lot of people have concerns about that.
Thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate the call. Bernie, to what extent do you think this argument that the Republicans are making, that the Senate's only job is to advise and consent, and that's really, basically that means rubber stamp, as opposed to the, what I would say, really the traditional American perspective, that because the judiciary is the third branch of government, really, there's a co-equal responsibility between the executive, the president, and the legislative to make sure that appropriate people are seated on the Supreme Court.
I mean, clearly, that is the purpose. That was the way it was written into the Constitution. Otherwise, they would have said, okay, the president, you know, has the right to appoint certain people without congressional approval. But for a position as important as the Supreme Court, the Senate plays the role of advice and consent. And obviously they have to be an equal party to that debate. If they don't like the candidate coming down, they're going to reject that candidate, which has happened obviously many times in our history. My hope would be is that the president would come forward. There are a lot of, you know, frankly intelligent, experienced, moderate, conservative, if you like, jurists who I think can win widespread approval in the Senate. But to bring forth somebody whose only experience is, or major share of experience, has been that they're loyal and a close friend to the President of the United States, you know, I have my doubts about that.
Yeah, it's almost, well, yeah, I don't, we'll set aside the conspiracy theories on it, where we're going. Jerry in Sacramento, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders, listening on 1240 Talk City, Sacramento. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, good morning again. Nice to talk to you once more, and hello to both of you.
Thank
My
you.
Question concerning corporate America's twist going to outsourcing everything overseas and putting more and more of us out of work or in low-paying jobs so we can no longer afford anything, who is going to be left to buy these products once they've outsourced them all, and even though they're only pennies, and we don't even have that to pay for these products, they're missing who their target is as far as the consumer is, I should say.
Well, that's a good question, Jerry, and I think many of these corporate executives really, A, don't particularly care about the middle class in America and whether or not they're going to be able to afford to buy the products, and B, they're looking very, very short term. What they're looking at is what next quarter's returns are going to be. They're looking at the kind of compensation that they can get, and in fact, in many instances, these guys are doing very, very well. Many companies' corporate profits are high. CEOs are doing extraordinarily well. CEOs of large corporations last year saw a 54% increase in their compensation. They're doing pretty good. But what I have to tell you, and people are going to have to, you know, come to terms with this, these large corporations should not be seen as American companies. They are not American companies. They are international companies who have no allegiance to the American people who made them great, to the consumers who purchased their products, to the workers who manufactured their products. These companies will go to any place in the world to manufacture if wages can be low. They will go to any country in the world where they don't have to pay taxes, and that's what they are about. And it's high time that we recognize that and that we change that. If we don't rebuild our manufacturing sector in this country, if we don't stop the potential huge loss of high-tech information technology jobs, we are not going to have a middle class in this country, and our kids are going to have a substantially lower standard of living than we do, despite a huge increase in worker productivity. This is an issue we have got to just pay enormous attention to.
In other words, the spiral of wages and productivity is either going up or down, but it doesn't stay flat.
That's right.
And we're in a downward spiral right now as a result of these policies.
And what I fear is we're not just chipping away at the middle class. I think that we are beginning now to see huge cutbacks. Pensions that were promised to millions of workers, forget about them. Health care, forget about it. More and more workers are employed at companies where either there are no health insurance benefits at all, or that there have been significant cutbacks, and wages are now, in a number of cases, being chopped very significantly. So we're looking not just at a slow decline in the standard of living of working people, we're looking at some real significant reductions.
It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM-440-8466. Bernie's website, bernie.org. And Patricia in Newberry Springs, California, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi there, Congressman.
Hi, Patricia.
It's a privilege to be able to talk with you today.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, and you, I think you partially discussed that in your previous answer, is there any way to salvage the middle class? Is there any way to put an end to this war on the middle class?
Yes, there is. And there are a number of things that we have to do. First of all, we have to recognize it. And we have to understand that when the president or anybody else tells you, oh, the economy is really doing good, that is a crock. It may be doing well for the wealthiest people in America, but it is not doing well for the middle class, and it's certainly not doing well for low-income people, with 5 million more people in poverty than was the case 5 years ago. What do we have to do? Well, for a start, we need to do what the rest of the industrialized world has done, and that is pass a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. That will not only protect the middle class, but what that will also do is improve our economy, because companies will not have to figure out how they can provide health insurance to their workers. We have to change our trade policy so corporate America reinvests in America.
Bernie, we'll have to grab the rest of that on the other side of this break.
Okay.
We're talking with Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie, bernie.org. It's Bernie's website if you want to check it out. We'll be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of By and For We the People. Yes, Bernie?
Patricia asked, you know, the $64 question in many ways, and that is how can we save the middle class? And I think at the heart of it, we have got to attack this culture of greed, which is so pervasive among the higher echelons of our country today. And what we have got to do is say, no, you don't need hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. You don't need billions of dollars. With all of the technology out there, with all of the increased worker productivity, can we provide health care to all people? Of course we can. Can we have excellent quality education for all people from childcare through college? Of course we can. Can we create a great deal of wealth? Yeah. But it is wrong when we have a system which the distribution of wealth and income is so unfair and getting more and more unfair every single day. And unfortunately, the media, for pretty obvious reasons, doesn't talk about that issue. But that is an issue that the American people have got to start demanding some resolution to.
You know, there was a time, Bernie, and when Teddy Roosevelt was president was the last time I think that we really... Well, that was the first time in the 20th century it really started the debate. And then, of course, Franklin Roosevelt picked it up when it was appropriate to ask the question, how rich is too rich? At what point does an individual family accumulating wealth actually start to represent a threat to democracy, to quote Thomas Jefferson? And that's a discussion that now is virtually taboo. If you say,
right.
say things like that, oh, there should be an inheritance tax to stop us from having a landed gentry, people say that you're a communist or a socialist or
right.
some kind of thing like that.
So that is precisely the issue that we have to focus on. I don't think anybody begrudges people who make a lot of money. That's fine. A lot of these business people have made huge contributions, created jobs. We respect that. But when is, in fact, enough enough? If the wealthiest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%, if the richest 17,000 families earn more income than I think the bottom 20 million families, when is enough enough? And that is the kind of debate and, I think, discussion we need to have.
Right. And the ways to respond to that are with a progressive income tax, with inheritance taxes. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, I am. But I'm also thinking about that there has to be a change in the culture of the very rich. No one wants to take away, you know, what they have. Or all that they have, for sure. I mean, these people are entitled to have a decent standard of living. You're not going to have everybody earning the same income.
Sure.
But you don't need the kind of income spread and unfair distribution that we currently have. And people should feel good about contributing to the general welfare rather than this culture is, gee, I only have $5 billion. I need $10 billion. And I don't care that there may be children down the street who are sleeping, you know, out in the street or kids in America who don't have enough to eat. There are other things in life other than earning zillions and zillions of dollars. And I think that's a culture that we have got to try to change if this country is going to succeed.
Well said. Sam, I don't see a city for you on the screen
hey,
here, but you're live and on the air with Bernie.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Where are you, Sam?
I'm in Sacramento. I'm sorry. I'm breaking up on you, huh?
Okay. No, you're just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my question is, first of all, I agree with your point. It's not profit. It is clearly greed. Here's the deal. If we live in a country where we have minimum wage laws on the book, why would we not consider legislation for maximum wage laws? The disproportionate numbers that consistently go to CEOs, and it doesn't make sense. They always justify that if you have raised the minimum wage, you will not be able to hire people, but yet you can justify paying one guy a couple $100 million. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, Sam raises, you know, a good question. I think the way you address that is with a fair and progressive income tax, which, by the way, we used to have in this country under radical communists like Dwight D. Eisenhower, which says that it is wrong that if you're making zillions of dollars, you're not paying a substantial part of that in income tax so that other people can have benefits that they need to have a decent standard of living. So I think that is the direction that we've got to go. But bottom line is we have got to address the growing gap between the rich and the poor and the collapse of the middle class. And that is an issue that has got to be front and center on the political table.
Neil in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're live with Bernie.
Yeah, good morning.
What?
My question simply is, Congressman, how do you explain to your constituents that when with this investigation regarding the identity of an undercover operative CIA is outed, How do you explain to your constituents how that affects national security, especially when that information is released from top government officials? Because as a former military officer and as a former intelligence professional, this concerns me a great deal. How can you explain the consequences of that to your constituents?
Well, what we know is that that's not very hard to explain. And what we know is that people in the CIA are outed, especially by government officials, this endangers the lives of our own intelligence operatives, which clearly at a moment like this is a horror. I mean, it's incomprehensible that people in the administration might be outing our own intelligence people. Second of all, this whole business, of course, has to do with the argument that Saddam Hussein was acquiring nuclear weapons and whether or not that information was doctored, was intentionally falsified, so that the president can then go on and say, boy, we have to go to war because this guy has nuclear weapons. What role possibly did government people have in that? So there's a lot of questions there that have got to be asked, and, you know, we're watching this investigation by Fitzgerald very closely.
Thank you, Neil. Vince in Chicago, we're getting pretty short on time here. Vince, what's up?
Hi, Bernie. It's an honor to speak with you. First of all,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're out of time, Vince.
Okay.
I'm very sorry.
Okay.
It's Bernie. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, my pleasure.
I do appreciate it. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Every week we have Congressman Bernie Sanders on Bernie.org, the website www.bernie.org. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. And you are listening to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, I don't think so. No, neither is GE or NBC or Disney or no. They're corporations. It's a whole separate thing. Andy Borowitz today. Vital report. Important to understand. BorowitzReport.com. Saddam demands Harriet Myers as his judge. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein threw another monkey wrench into his upcoming trial for crimes against humanity today, demanding that Harriet Myers, President Bush's latest choice for the United States Supreme Court, serve as judge for that trial. According to close associates, Mr. Hussein likes his chances, quote unquote, of beating the charges against him if a non-judge is presiding. While some legal experts saw the former strongman's latest demand as yet another delaying tactic, those close to Mr. Hussein said that his ardor for Ms. Myers is authentic. Reportedly, the Iraqi madman was watching television when Mr. Bush introduced his new nominee. And when Mr. Hussein learned that she had no judging experience whatsoever, he leaped up from his prison bed and declared, "Bring me Harriet Myers!" Mr. Hussein supposedly has told associates that with a non-judge presiding at his trial, he would be able to use what he called weapons of mass disruption, such as inappropriate and excessive objections, motions, and even bathroom breaks. But President Bush, attempting to nip Mr. Hussein's latest strategy in the bud, gave his demand a big no-can-do at the White House today. Harriet Myers, said Mr. Bush, does not have the judging experience to deal with an evildoer as wily as Saddam Hussein. And the only way she can get that experience is by serving on the United States Supreme Court. Yeah. Andy Borowitz. BorowitzReport.com. Used with permission. Thank you very much, Andy. Today, George W. Bush is, as the hurricane approaches Florida, it's passing over Cancun Cozumel as we speak, Hurricane Wilma! George W. Bush hops on his plane and heads to California. Sort of like he did with Katrina, except at least this time, apparently they're keeping him up to date. You'll recall with Hurricane Katrina, for 4 days, he had no clue what was going on because he refuses to read newspapers for fear he'll read something about himself that will make him feel bad, and he refuses to watch television news. He says he prefers to get his information from his own people. And they, after 4 days of Hurricane Katrina and people drowning and dying, and Michael Brown, who, by the way, is still on the still drawing a salary, still on the staff of FEMA. They just extended his 30-day contract another 30 days. He's working from home now. Michael Brown, who when his staffer said, "There's people dying down here in New Orleans," had his secretary respond, "Mr. Brown needs more than 30 minutes to have lunch. We have to deal with the waiter. We have to deal with the busboys. We have to get into the restaurant. We'll handle this later." Essentially, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but anyhow. So George W. Bush, eventually, after 4 days, his people, the Dan Bartlett, I guess, ended up getting the unsavory task, but four of them got together in the White House and drew straws to decide who was going to have to give him the bad news. The people were dying in Louisiana because he was out there eating cake with John McCain and playing the guitar and, you know, flying around and promoting Social Security and all this kind of stuff. And, in fact, the story in the Los Angeles Times, as I recall, that talked about this at the time, talked about how the last time one of his aides had to give him bad news, the guy had the dry heaves for a half hour as a result of it, because people are just so terrified that Bush will go into one of his periodic rages and, you know, start screaming and stomping around, and you know, nobody wants to have the President of the United States raging at them, and apparently his wrath is not only very obscene, but very intimidating. So anyhow, this time, apparently, they're keeping him up to date, and so, you know, we'll see what happens. But in any case, the bigger story is that he's out in California to, theoretically, to join Nancy Reagan in Simi Valley to open the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, a new pavilion of it that features the old Boeing 707 that carried Reagan and six previous presidents. And it's called the Air Force One Pavilion. And you can even see his beloved jelly beans on his presidential conference table. Which makes you wonder, let's see, Alzheimer's, mad cow disease, cow products, jelly beans, gelatin, boiled cow bones. Could it be? Nah, no chance. Well, in any case, you can even see his famed jelly beans there. But Arnold Schwarzenegger is not all that happy with the fact that Bush is coming out there, because Schwarzenegger is trying to push this thing, this ballot initiative, which is going to be on the ballot November 8th, you know, just coming up shortly here, a week and a half or so, requiring public employee unions to get written permission from their members before their dues can be used for political purposes. Now, this sounds really somewhat rational when the cons put it out the way they put it out. They say, hey, you know, people are paying dues to their union, and they may not want those dues used for political purposes. I mean, you might have a good Republican in the union, and he doesn't want his money being given to a Democrat or vice versa. And so if the union is going to engage in political activity, they should have to jump through the hoops of getting a written, you know, approval from every, which, of course, is going to render unions politically impotent, effectively. It's going to bust the ability of unions to engage in political action of any sort, really, of any consequence, at least with any dexterity, with any speed. But it also raises the question, if a company that I work for is giving money to a corporation, now, it's not my dues that are making that company succeed, but it's my labor that's making that company succeed. I mean, if everybody in a company stopped working, the company ceases to exist. The only thing that makes a company is its employees. Companies can't make things with no people. Even a fully automated company still has to have somebody running the automation. So a company is its employees, just like a union is its members. And so if you're going to say, well, union members, that unions can't use union money for political activity without the permission of their union members, then why not say corporations can't use corporate money without the permission of their employees, without the written permission of all of their employees? Or you could make the argument that the corporation is owned by its stockholders. I mean, you can make either argument, and all the stockholders have to provide their written permission every time the corporation does anything political. I mean, isn't what's good for the goose good for the gander here? Why only unions? Well, I think you know and I know that this is part of a frontal assault. This is a continuation on Ronald Reagan's war on the middle class, the conservative war on labor, on the American middle class, on the American working class. And ironically, it was started by a guy who was a Republican governor of California, Ronald Reagan. And now it's being promoted again in a very, I mean, this could be a very big deal if Schwarzenegger gets this thing pushed through in California. A lot of other states would follow. Another Republican governor of California, another corporatist Republican governor of California, another Republican governor of California is in the pockets of the corporations. And this just seems, you know, capping state spending. He also has this thing and a probation, extending the probationary period for teachers, which is really all these things are about essentially union busting or diminishing the ability of we the people or we the workers to have a say in things. And the cons will say, oh, no. We're trying to give union members more of a say in how their union dollars are used. Yeah. I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. I mean, it's just because the fact of the matter is that unions are essentially mini democracies. Unions elect their leaders, and if the union rank and file don't like the way that the leaders are using the union money, and they don't like the politicians that they're supporting or the political positions that they're taking, they will vote them out. And it certainly has happened many, many times in the history of unions in the United States. It's just like, you know, in the United States, you don't like the way your congressman is voting, or your congresswoman, or your member of the Senate, vote them out. You don't like what the president's doing, vote them out. In the workplace, you don't, as an employee, you don't even have the power to vote out your boss. So you could argue that it's even more important that a corporation get the permission of all of its employees before it use its money for political purposes. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's tit for tat, but heck, you know all that. So when George number one brought in the big guns and chased me out of Kuwait...
Oh, it's the old Saddam song. Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour.
Well, it didn't quite...
21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866... 440-8466, 1-866-440-THOM. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program. Ellen Ratner?
Yes.
Yeah, you're live on the air.
Okay, well, I got news for you. When you think that the Bushies maybe finally figured out that they ought not to be treading on new territory, Condoleezza Rice comes out today. She had a meeting with reporters. I was not there. And she basically said that that Syria has to be accountable for the assassination in Lebanon, And they are also considering United Nations resolutions to condemn Syria.
I have been saying for 2 years that the war that the Republicans will have for the 2006 elections is Syria, and the war that the Republicans will have for the 2008 election will be Iran.
I was in Syria 2 years ago. Best food I have ever eaten. If they have embedded journalists, I'm first to go. But that's a joke.
Yeah.
But I will tell you that it is very clear that they are setting that up by her remarks today. There's just no question.
Yeah.
And that is...
And this has been coming actually for some time now.
Right.
We've been doing Cambodia-like operations on the Syrian border, you know, and we've actually crossed the border into Syria and been engaged in hostile action in that country for some months now.
Well, of course, because one of the things that what we're doing is we're quote-unquote preventing the insurgency from coming into Iraq. But all we needed to do to prevent the insurgency from coming into Iraq was to patrol the darn borders in the first place, which
right.
they never did after the war. They were just open forest borders.
Right. Plus, the insurgency isn't coming into Iraq. I mean, there may be a few foreign fighters coming in, but the bottom line is this insurgency is homegrown. And you can't have an insurgency. You can't have an insurgency without popular support. People will turn you in.
Exactly. And, in fact, people came in very much from the southern borders. They did not really come in from the Syrian borders because the Syrians had no great love for Saddam Hussein in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, they say it's a Ba'athist party, but it's like calling a Democratic Party in Germany the same as a Democratic Party in the United States.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Also, DeLay today had his arraignment, but he basically got it postponed, as I understand it. He stood on the courthouse steps, and he said that this was an indictment against him because Ronnie Earle didn't like his redistricting. However, now they are asking for a change in venue and also a change in judges, and don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but they want the judge to excuse himself from the case, or they want the presiding judge of the administrative district to hear the recusal motion, and I guess they feel that the judge may be a Democrat, so therefore they don't want him on this case.
Heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid. And as the other thing that we are finding interesting is that they were going to consider the stem cell bill in the Senate. They have postponed that till at least January. And then that means that it kind of releases Frist from being held to the fire on this issue. Also, apparently, there is some rumor around town that the Republicans are encouraging Gingrich to run in 2008 because they are afraid of Giuliani or McCain being too liberal for the party, and therefore if Gingrich runs...
for president?
That's right.
You're kidding. Newt Gingrich for president. His negatives are so high.
Well, I mean, when you say that to the Republicans, they say to you, well, you think Hillary's negatives aren't high? So they want somebody who they feel are going to carry, you know, their lines and their water. And so they don't want somebody who can necessarily win. They want somebody who's going to carry their whole viewpoint out.
Yeah, well, I'm still predicting that the former head of the former president of what became ES&S, the big voting machine company that counts so many of the votes across the United States, Chuck Hagel, is going to be the Republican candidate. But, you know, what do I know?
Would be interesting, but I mean, honestly, if Giuliani or McCain have some chance to win against Hillary, but Newt Gingrich, I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, good point. Alan, thanks so much for being with
us. You're very welcome, and
Alan,
I will talk to you on Monday.
Okay.
Have a great weekend.
Indeed, you too. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, we've just got about a minute. What's up?
Okay, I just wanted to talk really briefly about what you were saying about the propositions here in California. And it's a very, very important election that people listening in California need to get out and vote on these propositions, because it's not really just a state election. It's really technically a national election. What they're trying to accomplish here in California, they're going to take to other states.
Oh, yeah, this is going to be a model. If Schwarzenegger can pull
Absolutely.
This off, you're going to see it in 20 or 30 other states in 06.
And in every one of these propositions, there is some tricky language that is their real point of the proposition. Like 73, they want to get it into our state constitution that a fetus is a child. And every single one of the proposition has tricky language like that. And I just want to make one quick point about 75. That's the one where the unions can't contribute to political campaigns. And here in California, in the last election, or most elections, unions only put in $1 for every the corporations put $4 for every union $1 in. So
that's
it's
amazing.
A corporate thing, not a union thing. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Amy.
Bye.
Much appreciated. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America.
We're going to stay with what we have.
Here they come again. Catch us if you can. Time to get a move on. We were young with all of our might. Catch us if you can.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. We have, I believe we have, Dr. Helen Caldicott on the line with us. Do we, Dr. Caldicott?
Yes.
Dr. Caldicott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. We were trying to get a little better landline on you for you. Is that working out, or are we going to do this with your cell phone?
No, we're doing it on the cell phone, but I think you can hear me, right?
I can. And you sound just great. Helen Caldicott is the founder and president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. The website is nuclearpolicy.org. You're going to be having a press conference in a week or so here. It's already starting, Dr. Caldicott. The discussions, the bloviating on the corporate right about how, yes, maybe there is global warming. Maybe we are reaching peak oil, and so therefore we need to build more nuclear power plants.
Yes, well, it's been a great gift to the nuclear industry because they were in their death throes after Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. They are now putting out false advertising saying that they don't produce any emissions or any global warming. They produce a large quantity of carbon dioxide. They use three huge coal-fired plants to enrich their uranium. They produce a lot of CFC gas, which damages the ozone through leaking pipes, but also is 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2.
Oh, hang on just a second. So you're saying that the type of gas that is produced by a nuclear power plant is actually more potent than the carbon dioxide that's simply produced by an oil or gas-fired plant?
No, it's not by the nuclear reactor itself. It's when you're making the fuel for the reactor. You have to dig up the uranium using fossil fuel, and you have to enrich it. And it's the enrichment process to make the actual fuel for the nuclear power plant that creates so much global warming gas.
So for a megawatt of power, a megawatt of electricity, a million watts of electricity produced by a gas-fired plant or a coal-fired plant versus a nuclear plant, what's the difference in the production of carbon-based greenhouse gases?
Yeah, that's a perfect question, Tom. At the moment, nuclear power produces one-third the amount of CO2 as a gas-fired plant, which is a fair bit, but as the quality of the air decays or degrades, and it will over time, there will be no net energy production. A huge amount of CO2 will be produced by nuclear power. And if all electricity plants in the world now were replaced by nuclear power, there's only 3 years' supply of uranium left in the world. So it's a very finite resource and totally dependent upon fossil fuels to create the fuel itself.
So, in other words, we have to use fossil fuels to run the equipment that digs up the uranium. We have to use fossil fuels to run the trucks that transport it. We have to use fossil fuels to enrich it. We have to use fossil fuels to transport it to the plants. When you add in all that fossil fuel that is used to get the uranium into the plant, how long does that uranium in that nuclear power plant have to be boiling water and producing electricity before it's actually generating net electricity? That is, until you've paid back all the fossil fuel that went into that.
Well, the estimates are about 10 to 18 years before you get one net calorie of energy back. 10 to 18 years. And the things are only meant to last for 30 to 40 years. However, the nuclear industry is extending their lifespan, which is medically unwise because as the nuclear power plant ages, so the pipes become embrittled and they're likely to break and crack, and you're likely to have a major accident, if not a meltdown, releasing as much radiation as that released by the explosion of a 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs.
Yeah, now you said...
It's becoming very, very dangerous.
Now, you said if we went to entirely nuclear power all around the world, there would only be a 3-year supply of uranium, but that's replacing an enormous amount of fossil fuel. Where, however, is most of that uranium that would be used to fuel? I understand Iran is actually sitting on a lot of uranium.
Yeah, no, it's Australia. You can tell by
Australia.
My accent, I'm Australian.
Yes.
We own 40% of the world's richest uranium. We've got very scientifically and medically ignorant politicians, all males, who want to dig it up as fast as they possibly can and sell it. So when we sell uranium, we're selling cancer, leukemia and genetic disease for future generations, because when you're fishing uranium, you make massive quantities of radioactive waste. No one knows where to put it. At the moment, it's leaking into the water supplies, concentrating in the food chains, and will over time produce epidemics of those malignant diseases and genetic disease for all future generations, but particularly in children, because they're so sensitive to radiation. I just did grand rounds at the LA Children's Hospital. I've just come from there. All my colleagues understood that immediately. This is a medical problem. It's a medical problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, the founder and president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, nuclearpolicy.org on the Internet. And great having you back on the program again, Dr. Caldicott. The current issue of either Time or Newsweek, I forget which it is. I was on a plane last weekend and I was reading it, and it had an article about where is all the plutonium, and it showed a map of the United States, and it showed, you know, there's 40 tons here and there's 20 tons here and there's 10 tons here. And I remember a conversation I had with John Goffman like 25 or 30 years ago where he said something to the effect of, and please recalibrate this for me or tell me what the accurate number. He said something to the effect of a few ounces of plutonium, if effectively distributed around the planet, was enough to kill every human being on Earth.
1 pound.
One pound?
16 ounces.
Yep. 16 ounces.
Yep, one pound. And each nuclear power plant makes 500 pounds of it a year. All you need is 10 pounds to make yourself an atomic bomb. The design's on the Internet, and it lasts for 500,000 years. It's half-life. Is 24,400 years. It causes lung cancer, bone cancer, leukemia, liver cancer, testicular cancer, and it damages the developing embryo like the drug thalidomide did to produce deformed and congenitally deformed babies.
So why on earth are we producing plutonium in these power plants? Why do we even have a nuclear industry if everything that you're saying is true?
Well, I'll tell you why. The nuclear energy industry is a socialized industry. And it's funny to have, you know, a free market economy and all capitalism, but this is a socialistic industry. It can't survive without... You can't buy insurance for your house or yourself in the event of a nuclear power plant accident. It's all covered by the federal government, your tax dollars. The reason being that it's an offshoot of the weapons industry. It's one and the same thing. They fission uranium to make plutonium to make bombs, 77,000 of them. And so then they said, we feel guilty about making bombs and killing all those people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so let's harness atoms for peace. That was 1956. But they knew at the time the toxicity of plutonium. They knew at the time the toxicity of strontium-90, cesium-137, radioactive iodine. They knew what they were doing, but they felt so guilt-ridden that this is an infant offspring of the weapons industry, both of which are continuing apace. George Bush wants to build 450 new hydrogen bombs a year, and that gives an example for all the rest of the world to say, if we're doing it, well, why don't you?
Yeah. Now, also, we find that we have dropped literally hundreds, I think perhaps thousands of tons of depleted uranium in Iraq, in Bosnia, in parts of Kuwait when we invaded there. Our soldiers are handling this stuff daily on aircraft carriers and tanks all around the world on a regular basis. What is depleted uranium? What's its relationship to the weapons and nuclear power industry? And you know, what are your thoughts on what we should do about it?
Okay, depleted uranium is uranium-238. When you dig up uranium, it's got two basic isotopes, 235, which is present in 0.7%, and that's the fissionable isotope for nuclear power and weapons.
0.7%, so that's less than 1%, the 235.
Uranium-235, less than 1%. So you have to enrich it to 3% for use in nuclear power plants, and that's where the CO2 is produced, at Paducah, Kentucky, at the uranium enrichment plant and the CFC gas. Now, the stuff that's left behind is called depleted. It's not depleted of radiation, it's depleted of uranium-235, and that's uranium-238. Now, it's lying around in millions of tons of tailings piles on Indian Navajo land, exceeding radon, which causes lung cancer, radium, which causes bone cancer and leukemia, and many of those populations, indigenous and Native American Indians, are dying in large numbers of cancer. One third of men who've mined uranium have died of cancer. But this uranium-238 is really magic for the Pentagon because it's free and it's 1.7 times more dense than lead. So if you make a solid anti-tank shell, not chips, solid, of 10 pounds, and you shoot it up from your cannon, it develops tremendous momentum and hits the other fellow tank and slices through the steel like a hot mastery butter. As it goes through the steel, it burns spontaneously, and up to 80% of that 10-pound burns, producing tiny microscopic particles that can be inhaled into the terminal air passages that lie around on the desert floor to be blown up by the dust storms forevermore, because the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. Now, what has happened in Basra, where they first went in 1991, and used 360 tons of this ordnance, the incidence of childhood cancer in children of very sensitive to radiation has gone up 7 times.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Dr. Helen Caldicott, I'm sorry, we have to wrap this up. The tyranny of the clock here.
The incidence of congenital has gone up 7 times. So the war in Iraq right now is a nuclear war. It's a medically disastrous thing.
You can learn more at nuclearpolicy.org. Dr. Caldicott, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a million sad stories on the side of the road. Strange how we all just got used to the blood. Millions of stories that'll never be told. Silent and frozen in the mud.
And welcome back, my friends.
Silent and frozen.
Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Check out thegreatwarming.com. Thegreatwarming.com. This is a movie that is going to be playing, I believe it's November 2nd on PBS. It's narrated by Alanis Morissette. It'll be on radios, on PBS stations all across the United States. And I'm in it, among others. It, in part, is based on my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Leonardo DiCaprio made a short web movie out of, that was, he says, inspired by that book. In fact, that's what it says at the end of it. You can see it on his website, leonardodicaprio.org. There's a link to it off tomhartman.com. But this is brand new. This is a full 1 hour film. And then the DVD version will have an extended interview with me on it, again, based on The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. So you can check it out at thegreatwarming.com. We're trying to get the word out about this thing because this is all about global warming, its consequences, its impact, what it's going to mean for you and me, how it's going to affect the world. You know, what does this mean? What is it all about? What's going on here? It's a beautiful website, by the way, that they have, thegreatwarming.com. And, you know, calling for action, letting folks know about it. Letting folks know about it, put together by Stonehaven Productions. So, anyway, that said, our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. Nat in Spokane, Washington, is on the line. Or is it Spokane, Nat?
Well, I have an idea for you.
Okay.
And I would like to email to you, but if you were to look up on the web right now, u-s-history.com/pages/h1682.html, you would come up with a history of U.S. savings bonds.
Okay.
It's the means by which our country, afforded the wars that we have needed to cover the costs of since the Civil War, in fact.
Yeah, well, the savings bonds are that part of the financing of the wars where we borrowed it from ourselves.
Right.
I mean, I remember when I was a kid, in the 50s in school, in the late 50s, we had these things where you could buy, they brought in these cards where you'd put a dime or a quarter in there, and when you get enough of them, you could buy a $10 savings bond. And it was, you know, to help in the Cold War, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyhow, your point.
My point is this. When we borrow from ourselves, we support ourselves economically. When we borrow from foreign powers, we weaken ourselves economically.
Sure.
So, why should we not support a bond drive to support popular things that are good for our country, like, for instance, the costs that will be incurred in salvaging our Gulf coastline?
Yeah, or our schools. I mean, this is the way that communities typically raise money, is they float a bond. Fortunately, the way that the governments have the power to encourage people to buy these bonds by making them tax-free. So those people who are looking to invest money and get a safe and reliable return, it's not usually a large return. You know, I think most tax-free municipal bonds right now are and state and county bonds are returning between 2% and 3%. But, you know, that's tax-free. So for somebody in a high tax bracket, that might be the equivalent of a 6 or 7% return, which is pretty good, or at least a 5% return in this day and age. So, you know, that's already happening.
But isn't there a further benefit in our lowering our taxes because we have less interest to pay to foreign powers?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
When you have to pay a service debt, and I would say that any time that you ship money out of the country, you're lowering our economic buying power, which increases
sure.
the need for taxes.
Well, it's not so much that it increases the needs for taxes. What it does is it puts us into debt relative to other countries. And so then what happens is those countries come to the United States and they say, hey, we've got all this debt of yours. You owe us. We'll take this factory. We'll take that factory. We'll take this company. We'll take this chunk of land. We'll buy this forest. And you end up with your country no longer being owned by you.
Which means that people are less employed.
Maybe or maybe not. But for example, people say, like the Japanese auto manufacturers, they come to the United States, they're providing jobs. Well, yeah, they're providing jobs, but where are the profits going? If it's a U.S. automaker, the profits are staying here. If it's a Japanese automaker, the profits are going back to Japan. How did they get the money to build the plants in the first place? Because we had a trade deficit with Japan. We were buying more from them than we were selling to them. And so they said, hey, we got a bunch of these dollars. What can we do with them? The only place we can spend them is in the United States. We'll come over and we'll buy, you know, we'll build a factory in Kentucky or something. And, you know, that's how it works. That's how it plays out.
And how has that been allowed to happen?
That's been allowed to happen as a consequence of trade policies that started by and large. I mean, some of this started actually under Jimmy Carter, but by and large, this started under Ronald Reagan and then picked up speed under George Herbert Walker Bush. And then really the doors got kicked out under Bill Clinton, where we said the old way of saying, hey, you know, we really should have balanced trade. If you look at the balance of trade, the trade deficit, it was flat from the 1930s right up through, I think, around 82. I think 82 was the first year that we actually started going into a trade deficit. And then it really started falling off the edge of the earth in the 90s. And it's because we changed our trade policies. We said we're going to, instead of us making decisions about trade, us making decisions about, you know, what products we want to import into the United States and what products we want to manufacture in the United States, we're going to turn those decisions over to multinational corporations and let them make those decisions by letting them make the rules of WTO and NAFTA and CAFTA and GATT and that sort of thing. And that's when it happened. And so, as Bernie said in the last hour, it's all working to the benefit of multinationals and not to the benefit of Americans. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone on the banks of the Willamette River in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program, I am originating from Portland. It's being mixed ably by Alex in New York City and Dan answering the phones and then beamed off into outer space up to the Westwood satellite and off to the Jones satellite and back down to the Sirius satellite. And it's incredible. Technology is amazing. You know, it's just amazing. When I was a kid, I was a ham radio operator. And I used to, when I was 13, I got my license. And I was just so amazed by, you know, you make a sound, and it's like, you know, my vocal cords are vibrating, and this microphone then vibrates, and now there's a speaker that you're hearing that's vibrating, and all the stuff that happened in between, all the hundreds of millions of little links and relays, and, you know, from here to New York, and from New York to Denver, and from Denver up into the satellite, and from the satellite back down to New York, and then back up to the satellite, and then down. It's just incredible. I'm sure I sound like, you know, somebody from the Neolithic who had just saw their first airplane. But I'm continuously in a state of wonder. I was talking with the folks at Stonehaven Productions during the break, who put together the movie, The Great Warming. And the program will be on PBS at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, coast to coast, on public broadcasting on PBS TV. At 8 o'clock on November 2nd. So check out November 2nd, the program on global warming. And there is actually not a website for that specific program. The earlier movie that they did about the Great Warming is the website that I gave you. This is kind of a spinoff from that. And as I said, I will be in this thing on PBS for what it's worth. You know, if you want to, I'm in a bunch of these things that are out there, like Unprecedented and some of these other. But anyhow, it's fun. It's a hoot. But in particular, this is a really good documentary on global warming. I mean, if you want to understand the topic, if there's somebody in your family that you want to say, hey, you know, here's how it really works, this is what it's really all about, then this is one that you want to see. So November 2nd on PBS, 8 p.m. Eastern time. And, well, check your directories. I mean, sometimes PBS stations will time delay things or they'll move them around a day or so. So check your directory for the global warming thing, right? You know, plus or minus, or it would be on or after November 2nd. The National Guard in the United States, which is at its first level under the command of the governors of the states, and can be federalized in case of a national emergency to a certain extent. The National Guard and Reservists now representing 50% roughly of the soldiers in Iraq, which is a disaster, both for the Army and for the Guard and the Reserve. But the bigger disaster here, the National Guard is losing their equipment. This is just the Oregon example of it. Every state has their story of it. So this is a for example. Whatever state you're in, There's a similar one where you live. This from the Oregonian, the local newspaper here, article by Mark Larrabee. He says, just before soldiers with Oregon's 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry Regiment, boarded a plane home from Iraq in March, they were ordered to turn in their weapons so replacements, that's replacement troops, could use them. The surprise order angered soldiers who had come to rely on their weapons for safety through a difficult year in combat, said Colonel Mike Caldwell, deputy director of the Oregon National Guard. Now, here's where it gets really weird. The Oregon National Guard was supposed to have 64,000 in June, 64,000 pieces of equipment worth more than $1.2 billion. I'm sorry, the Army National Guard. This is the entire Army National Guard. That were left behind in Iraq. and half of it can't be accounted for by the Army. On average, across the United States, National Guard units are operating with 34% of their equipment. Two-thirds of their stuff is in Iraq. You wonder why, you know, Hurricane Katrina hits New Orleans. Where's the National Guard? They're in Iraq. They really were. Two-thirds of them. Where are the generators? They're in Iraq. Where are the amphibious vehicles? They're in Iraq. The Guard is leaving behind armored Humvees, large transport trucks, radio equipment, night vision goggles, other gear essential not only to soldiers fighting in Iraq, but also to units training and responding to problems at home. A September report by the National Guard Bureau states that the Guard needs $1.3 billion for new equipment to support its domestic missions. And here's, again, this is the story of Oregon, but it's emblematic. It's an example. 12 of Oregon's 13 Guard battalions have already deployed overseas. The Oregon Guard is bracing for its next mission in March, sending hundreds of soldiers to Afghanistan. Half the troops, the problem has been magnified by the Iraq conflict, half the troops sent there have been in the National Guard or Reserve. This hasn't happened since World War II. And why? Because Bush wants to have a war on the cheap. Except it's not on the cheap because he's hiring all these contractors to do all this stuff with these no-bid contracts and throwing money at them who happen to have good Republican connections. So there's mind-boggling war profiteering. And who gets screwed? The Army and the Guard. And now they want to cut. They wanted to cut $600 million out of the VA budget. One Oregon engineering unit sent to Iraq 2 years ago came home with cranes and other heavy construction equipment that needed major repairs, a financial responsibility of the regular Army. The soldiers left those vehicles at Fort Lewis, Washington, where they still sit unfixed. During its response to Hurricane Katrina, the Louisiana National Guard was forced to rent heavy equipment because it had left its own in Iraq. They had to rent it. Now, this, you know, I'm not saying this to just, you know, say, well, isn't it a terrible thing? We, you know, the Guard is getting screwed. That's real. But the problem here is that our government is not being run like a government. And this is one of the reasons you have career people in the Army leaving the Army, career people in the CIA leaving the CIA. You've got the Colin Powell's assistant, Lawrence Wilkerson, coming out, speaking out against George W. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and saying these guys are incompetent. It's a cabal. They're destroying America's reputation around the world. They're harming our national security. They're making us less safe. They're making us more vulnerable to terrorism. Why? It's, you know, is it because they hate America? No. I know it's very fashionable on the Reich for the right-wing bloviators to say, oh, those liberals, they hate America, the hate America crowd, quack, quack, quack. It would be just as easy for me to say, oh, you know, look at the damage that they're doing to the National Guard. Look at the damage they're doing to the Army. They must hate America. But I know, and you know, that that's not true. I mean, just like we know that, you know, it's a lie when they say that the so-called left, which is really the average American, I mean, there is no left in America. The communists and the socialists, the people who believe that the government should own all the factories, they died out in the 50s. Joe McCarthy took them out. They're gone. Well, and then people saw the excesses of Stalin and communism, and, you know, they became a joke. There is no left in the United States. Instead, what there is traditional American values. We'd like clean air. We'd like clean water. We'd like a safe food supply. We'd like an army that works. We'd like police departments that are well-funded, that are appropriately paid. We'd like to have appropriate minimum wage laws and the ability of unions to negotiate contracts so that the cops can afford to live in the neighborhoods that they police. And these are not liberal things. These are traditional American values. We'd like to have decent, you know, we'd like to know that if somebody puts in their 40 hours, if they put in 25 years, if they play by the game, they play the game by the rules, they get a decent pay. You've got that, and then you've got the right. There is no left in America. But anyhow, they say that those of us, what I call the radical middle, that we hate America. We know that. I don't think that Bush hates America either. I think, though, that these guys hate the idea of government. Now, why would they hate the idea of government? Because if you take down government, which is we the people, this incredible democratic experiment, if you take down government, you create a huge vacuum where all the commons, the water, the food, the air, the national parks, all the minerals that are in the ground, all that oil that's in Alaska, all that stuff, you can turn it over to private corporations who happen to be the right wing. Right? The right wingers, it's the right wingers represent inherited wealth and multinational corporations. Pure and simple. That's it. And when they say small government, what they're saying is they don't want the will of you and me, of we the people, to be exercised. They want it all for themselves. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, Mama. It's me, Osama. I guess you're worrying, wondering where I've been staying. Got in a world of trouble, lit out on the double, hiding out in Pakistan. I'm eating good, I'm praying.
Yeah, right. No, actually, he's dead. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And dare to say no, don't think so. Welcome back to our program. We're talking about the Guard being drained of gear and really it being symptomatic of a larger problem, and that is that you can't govern if you don't believe in government. It's just that simple. If you don't think that government is a good thing, if you don't think that government is an appropriate thing, if you don't think that the people should be represented, if you think that the only folks who should be represented are the wealthy, to quote Thomas Jefferson referring to John Adams' constituency, the well-born and the well-bred. If you think they're the only ones who should be represented, or as George Bush said before a fundraiser, you know, here I am among the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. If you think that's who should be represented, then of course you're in favor of small government. Because it creates a power vacuum, a vacuum of control into which big corporations and wealthy interests can step. On the other hand, if you think that we all have a social contract with each other, that we, you know, that police and fire protection is appropriate, that we want to have good schools, in fact, that we even want to have free public education going all the way up through college, so that if somebody is born into poverty, they still have the opportunity to become a doctor if they have the ability and move from one social economic class into another economic class easily. If you want to have that kind of mobility, in other words, if you want to have the American dream, then, you know, there's a price for that. And the price is, and it's the price, by the way, of liberty and democracy. It's the cost of a free society. The price is taxes and government. Making sure that it's a government that's accountable to we the people. We've got parts of this government that have completely run amok and are no longer accountable to us at all. The Pentagon, in large part, for example. And all these secret operations that are being run by the White House, spying on you and me. That's not what the founders envisioned. And at the same time, you've got large chunks of the government. I mean, here, Representative Mike Pence, Republican from Indiana, he's chairman of the Republican Study Committee. He's pushing House conservatives to slash $50 billion from student loans, Medicare, and Medicaid. Why? So they can have more tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires. And he sends an email out to the Republican Study Committee, sends an email out to all of their members, opening with a quote from George Washington. Now, this was what Washington said when he was called to lead the Revolutionary Army. When they asked him sir, will you please lead the army? He said, my diffidence in my own abilities was superseded by a confidence in the rectitude of our cause and the patronage of heaven. So you get Mike Pence, the Republicans, quoting this. Come on, guys. To make the rich richer? I don't think so. Daryl in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Daryl, what's up? Daryl, you're live and on the air.
Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, excellent. Listen, a righty friend of mine that we go back and forth with all the time via email, his latest rant is Able Danger.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about it. I had to Google search it to find out any information. I just wondered what your take was on it and how important this thing is.
Able Danger, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, what I know is I think what pretty much everybody else knows, which is what Congressman Kurt Weldon has been ranting about, and he's been blasting the Defense Intelligence Agency. Yesterday or the day before yesterday he was on Lou Dobbs' program on CNN talking about how the DIA is still trying to cover this up. And basically, a year before 9/11, apparently, the Defense Intelligence Agency knew or was tracking some of the folks involved in 9/11. And he's of the opinion that we could have stopped 9/11 if the Defense Intelligence Agency had simply, you know, done its job or said something to somebody or kicked it all the way up to Rumsfeld or whatever. Some of this happened under the Clinton administration, some of it under the Bush administration. It happened under both of them. And the righties are, you know, of course, saying, oh, it's all Clinton's fault. That's what they say about everything. But the bottom line is that Kurt Weldon says it's still going on. The cover-up is still going on. And that the Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, as I recall is his name, who told him about it, who broke the story, essentially, has now been punished by the Department of Defense by being fired. He's losing his benefits. He's being kicked out and all kinds of stuff like that. So if Kurt Weldon is right, then there's something really stinky going on in the Department of Defense.
Right.
And they're doing their best to cover it up. And 9/11 could have been avoided if Kurt Weldon is right. And if he's wrong, then, you know, he's a conspiracy nut. I suspect he's probably right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And frankly, I got to say, I don't think that this is a right or left issue. I think this
I don't either.
Yeah, I think this is something we should all be concerned about. So anyhow, we'll see how it shakes out. But here's what Kurt Weldon, he says, yesterday, this is on C-SPAN, he says, yesterday I met with another Able Danger official. This official has impeccable credentials, can't reveal his name. He's in a meeting, he told me he's never been talked to by the Pentagon and the DIA in their investigation. Pentagon says all the material has been destroyed, but I have a senior official telling me there's a second pot of information. So now he says there's still stuff out there, even though they've tried to cover this thing up. Yeah, we'll see how it works out. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Harper.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Welcome back to our program. It's the end of the week and a good time to look back on the news and talk with some of the folks who really are out there with their fingers on the pulse of the media. They really know what's going on in the news, in the world of the news, the milieu of news. I'm lacking a phrase here, but it's sufficiently poetic. But in any case, you know what I'm talking about. Mark Carlin is here with us. He's the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How
great.
Are you doing?
I am just great, Mark, and it's marvelous to have you with us. And Paul Waldman, he's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be with you.
I am so glad to have you here. I make heavy use of both of your websites. You guys you're both just doing marvelous work out there, and the entire progressive America is I'm sure grateful to all of you. I mean, it's America. We have a chance of taking back democracy because of the work that you guys are doing. Paul Waldman, first, I'll start with you. What over the past week here do you see as having been the largest story, the story not necessarily the story of the moment, but the story that 6 months or a year, even 5 or 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, you know, that was a turning point. That was an important one.
Well, I would have to say it's the gathering storm here in Washington, and that's not Hurricane Wilma. The gathering storm is what some people on the blogs are beginning to call FITSMAS, Now, what
Fitzmas?
Fitzmas, yes. If you read blogs, you've noticed people talking about Fitzmas. Well, Fitzmas is the day when Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the Valerie Plame case, will be delivering his indictments. I have to say, as someone who is in Washington and the progressive community, every day it seems like we are all shaking our heads saying, my God, what else can come out about this White House and this Congress? It seems as though the entire edifice of Republican rule is just beginning to crumble.
Right, and every day there's something new, you know, another wheel coming off the cart.
There absolutely is, and we don't know yet who is going to be indicted, but it's beginning to look like the strongest possibilities are Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, and, of course, Karl Rove. They apparently are saying that there are strong indications that they are going to be indicted. Other people may be indicted. There are dozens of people to whom Patrick Fitzgerald has spoken and gotten testimony from. And, you know, what we, in all of this kind of back and forth and who talked to who and who gave the name to who, you can kind of forget what's at the heart of this, which is that this White House was so intent on destroying someone who was a political enemy that they revealed really extraordinarily sensitive national security information and in the process outed a CIA operative and really endangered American national security.
Right, they brought down an entire operation, Brewster Jennings, this entire operation that was out there offering to sell weapons, shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and things to terrorists as a way of pulling the terrorists in and finding out what's going on.
Exactly right, and that's how it really had an effect, because Valerie Wilson was using Brewster Jennings as a front company, a CIA front company, anyone who was later connected or beforehand connected to that front company was also exposed.
And right.
So, in danger of death.
And we still don't know how many people might. I understand some people may have actually died. Some people may have actually been killed because of this outing.
We're not sure. And it's remarkable to see so many Republicans saying, oh, this was no big deal. This is what happens in Washington all the time. People leak information. This is just political hardball. Well, I hope we have not gotten to that point. And it does appear that the prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, doesn't think that this is just run-of-the-mill politics.
Yeah, they're running around going, it's the criminalization of politics. That's what it is. Okay, Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. Mark Carlin, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Mark, what, you know, looking back on this week, what do you see as a seminal moment?
I think as a follow-up to what is the impending storm, perhaps we hope that the rumors of indictments prove to be true, but this week, as an indication that they might indeed happen, you started to see the thieves fall out, and in particular, Karl Rove's lawyer, an anonymous source, but clearly his lawyer, has indicated that Rove is now blaming Scooter Libby for revealing Valerie Plame Wilson's identity to him. Originally, Rove had said that came from a journalist.
Right.
But this week there was a development that Rove is saying that Scooter Libby told him. So that really is an ominous development for the White House when there are two key aides to Bush and Cheney, respectively. One of them is going after the other. The second development that was a real oddity that hardly got picked up other than the New York Daily News was that the New York Daily News Washington bureau chief wrote a story in which he said well-placed sources in the White House told him that George Bush had been furious with Rove about how clumsily the Plame outing had been handled.
Years ago,
and before, it seemed to indicate before and after he indicated that he had no knowledge of the outing. So it put him, his credibility certainly at risk, whether he's legally liable since he wasn't under oath when he was interviewed by the special prosecutor is a question that's out there.
Well, in fact, here's George W. Bush a year and a half ago.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
But it turns out that he was apparently lying when he said that.
Yes, and this New York Daily News article has largely gone unnoticed except for the web and, of course, the Daily News itself. But it allegedly came from people inside the White House and perhaps was another indication of how bumbling the White House has become, that it seems it may have been an attempt to
insulate Bush from this as though he disapproved of it, but actually, as in Watergate, we found the crimes are in the cover-up, and it
right.
makes Bush an accessory to the cover-up.
You know, I think most people, when they think back to Watergate, even those of us who are old enough to remember it and have, you know, followed it fairly closely at the time, don't have any idea what it was that the original burglars, the Bernard Barker and Gordon Liddy and those guys, were trying to get inside the Democratic National Headquarters. And in fact, there's still speculation to this day what that was. But, you know, it was a break-in, whether it was to plant a bug or whether it was to get specific information or what they were up to, you know, is still being speculated about. But in this case, we know that this has to do with punishing somebody for outing the administration in a lie that led to war. And I'm concerned that that is getting lost in the translation here, that 6 months, a year from now, indictments and no indictments, people go to jail, they don't go to jail, that the whole larger story of the administration lied and people died is being lost in the dust. Mark, very quickly, your thoughts on that, Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash.com.
I think that there's speculation that the U.S. Attorney and Special Counsel, Patrick Fitzgerald, who, by the way, is holding down two jobs, he is still the U.S. Attorney in Chicago, and I think most of America doesn't realize that. He's flying back and forth between Washington and Chicago, prosecuting in both locations. But I think that there is speculation that, indeed, his investigation has gone to the heart of what Paul has brought up, which is the White House Iraqi Working Group, codenamed WIG, and that, indeed, that he is getting deep into that as part of the background for what may be the indictments, and that there may not actually be indictments on the outing, but the indictments may be much deeper, having to do with a conspiracy.
Which would be the lying. You know,
Would be the lying and the cover-up and the perjury and, you know, rather extensive potential for indictments. I just quickly wanted to add one other quick development this week, which was another telling development of things breaking wide open, was Colin Powell's chief of staff, when he was in the State Department, gave a lacerating talk that completely shredded the Bush administration.
Lawrence Wilkerson.
Yeah. And it was an amazing, amazing speech for someone who was second in command to Colin Powell. And basically, Buzz Flash couldn't have been harder on Bush than the second in command to Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State. And you have to think that although he said that Colin Powell didn't support him coming out and saying this, you have to think with this man's loyalty, Colin Powell, he wouldn't have done it if Colin Powell didn't give him a wink and a nod.
Yeah, there you go.
So
Paul,
I think that's a real indication of the trouble the White House is in, regardless of the indictment.
I absolutely agree with you, Mark. Mark Carlin at BuzzFlash.com. Paul Waldman, we have about a minute left, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org. Paul, where do you think this is going?
I think the entire power structure in Washington, the Republican structure, is crumbling. And Tom, you bring up a point that's so important that we can't forget. You know, some people are going to try to make analogies between what Patrick Fitzgerald is uncovering and Ken Starr and the Monica Lewinsky affair. What the Bush administration did in this case that led to this investigation was a crime of extraordinary magnitude, even apart from the specifics of what happened with Plain. This was all about a war that they knew that they would not be able to sell to the American public if they were honest about it. And so they undertook a campaign of deception. And as part of that campaign of deception, they knew that they had to destroy anyone who got in their way. And Joseph Wilson and his wife, they were in that category.
They were right there, yeah. Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch how this plays out. Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters. Mark Carlin, editor and founder at BuzzFlash.com, MediaMatters.org. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with us today. And our best of the rest of the news segment. Much appreciated.
All right, bye-bye.
We'll talk to you again soon. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Yes, indeed. Speak out. Get out there. Get active. Participate. Go to democracyforamerica.org and join up. Go to democrats.org and join up. Go to republicans.org and join up. Get involved. It's I'm not being facetious. I think, you know, if you are inclined to think that, you know, the Republican Party reflects in some way some of your values, then participate in it. We need people, human beings in there, rather than just all this corporate money and all these corporate, you know, pushing of you know, corporate this, that, and the other thing, rather than just us. You know, it's just absolutely vital. And time for a piggy's alert, my friend.
Pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigot piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigot piggies stirring up the dirt.
Oh, but they always have...
Always have clean shirts.
Clean shirts, yes. They always have clean shirts. Our piggy alert for the day. It's incredible. The irony of this, absolutely mind-boggling. You go to the MSNBC website, and you know how they have the main story, and then they got the headlines down the side. And the main story, the headline, Senate votes against more heating aid for poor. That's the headline. And the related story down the side, Senate okays $50 billion more for war. Actually, for wars. It's plural. Go figure. For the second time this month, this is from the Associated Press, for the second time this month, the Senate voted against putting more money into a program that helps low-income families meet home heating costs. We are going, my friends, we are going back to the 1930s and the period before that when one of the major causes of death among low-income and elderly people was hypothermia in the winter. People froze to death. Because I guarantee you, there are going to be a lot of families with heating costs going up 20, 30, 40% this year. There are going to be a lot of families who will not be able to afford to heat their homes. You're going to see a lot of people, the oil truck just doesn't pull up. They didn't pay their bill. Senators who opposed the $3.1 billion in emergency money for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, also known as LIHEAP, L-I-H-E-A-P, said the aid would be dealt with as part of a larger emergency spending bill that Congress probably will consider soon. That sounds nice, right? Don't worry, we'll take care of it later. But in fact, it was a Republican, Susan Collins of Maine, who wanted to put this thing in. Who drafted this amendment along with Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, to add $3.1 billion to the Bush administration's $2 billion request for the program that helps low-income families with heating, cooling, and other energy-related home repairs. Reid and others said that with natural gas prices expected to rise by 50% and heating oil by more than 30% this winter, $5.1 billion is needed just to keep pace with the program's needs. 53 senators voted on Thursday for the amendment to the Transportation and Housing Bill, 7 short of the 60 needed to waive the budget rules on new spending. In other words, they needed 60 votes for this thing to pass. They only got 53. 46 senators opposing it. As Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, a sponsor of the measure, said, many families face a stark choice to heat or to eat. Earlier in October, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts picked up 50 votes, 10 short, again, of the 60 needed, when he tried to attach a similar spending bill to a defense appropriations bill. This is a program that started back in 1974, when the OPEC embargo happened and home heating prices spiked. To help out the poorest, it provides assistance to about 4 million households. Now, keep in mind, there's about 30 million people living on the edge in the United States. And 67% of all people living in poverty in the United States are working full-time jobs. This only touches 4 million. I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. And can we afford to help these folks out? No. No. Can't do it. Sorry. But that was $3.1 billion. They just said, but we got $50 billion for war. No problem. The compassionate Republicans, I'm telling you, they are just, you know, the compassionate Republicans are just so conspicuous. They're so there. You get it, right? That the conservative notion, the conservative worldview, is that them that have get more. That it's the old Calvinist notion that, you know, wealth is a sign of the blessing of God. It's a sign of virtue. It's a sign of goodness. And that poverty is a sign of moral failure and should be punished. Now, it doesn't explain how you had a whole bunch of very poor people who came to the United States from Europe, 50, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and now are doing very well. What, were they moral failures then and now they're not? It doesn't explain that. Economics explains that, but you know, that's the conservative worldview, and the traditional American worldview that they now call liberal is that, you know, you give people bootstraps, and more often than not, they'll pull themselves up by them. But you got to give them some bootstraps. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. We are all in this together. All of us Americans, we're all part of the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us, my friends, this week. Tom Hartman here with you. Thanks to Louise David Poole for producing the program this week and the folks in New York. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.